Sports Talk Chicago is now on the air. This is John Zaglul. I'll be your host for the next hour. A big show today as we preview the Super Bowl. A comprehensive preview. We're looking at each and every position, team by team. We're going to give advantages. We're going to pick a winner based on the point spread as well. We'll also take a look at the four newest members of the Baseball Hall of Fame. We'll look at other voting totals. Who didn't get in? Do they have a chance to get in next year? That was announced last Tuesday. We'll tell you about it today. Later in the show, we'll also talk about the Bulls, their acquisition of Carmelo Anthony, which wasn't publicized as much, so we'll talk about that, and then Zach LaVine and his recent comments about the team. But first, let's take care of a little housekeeping. Again, you're listening to 88.5 WHPK-FM Chicago. You can reach me personally on Twitter at John Z Sports, Instagram at John Zags, and Facebook at John Zaglul. Or you could visit me, sportstalkchicago.com, for more podcasts and articles. This week, I'm having Len Casper, Cubs TV voice, on the podcast, so make sure to check that out after today's show. All music that you hear in today's show is produced and performed by TMMRW, and he's on all music platforms, including Spotify and iTunes. He has a new song dropping this Friday with Juice WRLD, so make sure to check that out. Now, if you want to contribute to today's conversations, the phone lines, they'll be open all hour. You give me a call, 773-702-8424. Again, that's 773-702-8424. So we talked about the Super Bowl preview, and before we get there, let's recap what happened in the week before in the NFC and AFC championship games. Now, 2 weeks ago, we were able to witness two historically significant conference championship games. I mean, for starters, both games went to overtime, which is the first time in NFL history that that happened. We saw one of the most controversial calls, or should I say, non-calls in modern league history, as the missed pass interference penalty in the Rams vs. Saints game not only contributed to the Saints' stunning defeat, but at the same time has renewed serious interest in making penalties and lack thereof part of the challenge process, which I guess it's not a new idea, but it's gained more strength specifically after that one play. And obviously, because the Saints lost the game, because they're going to blame that loss on that one missed call instead of other missed opportunities, the debate in regards to penalties and challenges is at full strength. But I think most people can agree on this. By making every penalty or missed penalty open to the challenge, the NFL's pace of play will greatly decrease. And for a game that is only action for about 5 to 10 seconds at a time, that's something the league shouldn't risk. The league's ratings are down. I mean, they're up from last year, but they're down from 2015 as well. So by getting rid of pace of play, which is a problem in the NFL, by making every penalty challengeable, I feel like that is a grave mistake that the NFL is considering. Do I think it'll happen? Probably not, because change in the NFL is very hard to institute. But at the same time, realizing that this idea is on the table is not a good idea for the league and for its fan base. We also saw Greg Zuerlein of the Los Angeles Rams act as a foil or an opposite to Cody Parkey as he hit two immensely important kicks, including a shocking 57-yard field goal to send the Rams to the Super Bowl. And by the way, that's the longest game-winning field goal in NFL playoff history. The longest ever in NFL playoff history to win a game, that belongs to Greg Zuerlein. Meanwhile, here in Chicago, the Bears missed out on a first-round bye because Cody Parkey couldn't hit a game winner against Miami back in Week 6, and the Bears couldn't advance past the wildcard round in the playoffs this time around because, once again, Cody Parkey couldn't make a field goal. But Greg Zuerlein, on the other hand, showed Bears fans and all of America the true job of a kicker, which isn't to appear on the Today Show, it isn't to miss kicks, it isn't to act as a quote-unquote good or bad teammate, it's to make kicks. The job as a kicker is to make kicks, and that's what Greg Zuerlein did, and that explains why the Rams are in the Super Bowl. Case closed. In the AFC, the Chiefs had control of the game. They had a lead, they lost it, but they managed to advance to OT, where they, like so many other teams in the past, succumbed to the greatness of Tom Brady. Believe you me, it was difficult to watch the Patriots convert on three consecutive 3rd-and-10 situations in overtime. It was difficult to watch them pick apart the Chiefs' defense and continually march downfield. And it was extremely difficult to watch Rex Burkhead, of all players, punch it in from 2 yards out to send the Patriots to the Super Bowl. But as I had mentioned on last week's show, Chiefs fans should not be discouraged. You entered the season with essentially a rookie quarterback in Patrick Mahomes, because before the season began, Mahomes had only played in one game in his NFL career. Then during the season, you had lost a top five running back in the league in Kareem Hunt. That made Damian Williams the starter throughout the playoffs. So considering the expectations, considering you entered the year with essentially a rookie quarterback, considering you're in the middle of the year, and then your star running back gets taken away from you due to his own personal problems, I'd say job well done by the Chiefs. Then again, despite my forgiving attitude, it should be noted that Chiefs defensive coordinator Bob Sutton had been fired following the team's loss. It seems like it's unfair. I mean, he was only judged based on 5 minutes, technically, but this might be the reason why. Listen to this stat from ESPN. Quote, the Chiefs allowed 524 yards from scrimmage and 36 first downs Sunday night to the Patriots, who scored 2 go-ahead touchdowns in the final 3 minutes and 32 seconds of regulation before their 13-play game-winning touchdown drive in overtime. And remember, that 13-play game-winning touchdown drive in overtime was spearheaded by 3 straight 3rd-and-10 conversions. Look, is it right to fire a defensive coordinator based on 5 minutes of in-game performance, or technically 3:32 plus the time in overtime? Probably not. Because at the surface, this seems like an impulsive firing. It seems like the Chiefs are using Bob Sutton as a scapegoat for their loss. But looking at the big picture, looking back at the team's defense this season, it was ranked 31st overall in total yards. And although they did lead the league in sacks, that horrific ranking definitely justifies the firing. In the end, however, I think the Chiefs should be very happy with the season they put together. And if this offense shows up next year like it did this year, a Super Bowl appearance is not out of the question. Anyways, here we are. It's the Rams versus the Patriots, or as I like to say, the United States versus Boston. Because let's face it, no one wants to see the Patriots win another Super Bowl except for their own fan base. Now, whether you plan on watching the Super Bowl simply for the commercials or because you're actually interested in the game, the point is you need to know what to expect on Sunday. And that's why it's time for my comprehensive Super Bowl preview. We'll be going position by position for both teams. We're going to compare strengths and weaknesses, who has an advantage, who has no advantage. We'll also take a look at the Vegas odds and make a prediction for the game's results. So here we go, my Super Bowl preview right here on Sports Talk Chicago. It starts at the quarterback position, Tom Brady versus Jared Goff. Look, Tom Brady has 5 Super Bowl rings, 70,000 passing yards, 3 MVP awards, and 517 touchdowns. Jared Goff, on the other hand, has improved since his rookie year. Let's note that he's done much better than his rookie year, in which he had 6 touchdowns and 7 picks. But he's posted a passer rating of 83 or less in 5 of his past 7 games. Now, he's a warm-weather quarterback, and the Super Bowl will be inside a dome. So I'm expecting a good performance from Goff. I'm not expecting anything like what he did here against the Bears on Sunday Night Football. That being said, without a doubt, New England has the advantage at quarterback. I mean, seriously, how can you not take Brady over Goff? Brady has 5 Super Bowls, 70,000 passing yards, 3 MVP awards. Jared Goff has nothing. He has a good coach and a good offensive system, but even then, in comparison to Tom Brady, he has absolutely nothing. And as much as it pains me to say it, Tom Brady has an absolute advantage at quarterback, and the Patriots have an absolute advantage at that position. Now to running back. Todd Gurley and C.J. Anderson versus Sony Michel, Rex Burkhead, and James White. As I like to call it, the two-headed monster versus the three-headed monster in this case. But in this specific instance, I'm going to give the Rams, with their combination of Gurley and Anderson, a slight advantage over the Patriots. Look, Todd Gurley is a top 5 running back in the NFL, and for some time was even being considered for the league MVP award. And C.J. Anderson, despite not playing for most of the season, has stepped in and performed quite well in his role. As for Michelle, Burkhead, and White, I'm a fan of all three guys. I believe they're all talented, but they wallow in comparison to Gurley and Henderson. I mean, Gurley scored, I believe it was a combined 28 touchdowns this season, rushing and receiving. Michelle, Burkhead, and White, I guarantee you, do not have 28 touchdowns amongst the three of them. And C.J. Anderson, signed week 16, rushes for 100 yards in the playoffs, in a playoff game, rather. It's impressive. And it's way better than anything Michelle, Burkhead, and White have done. Both of them greatly outnumber him, advantage to the Rams at the running game. Now to the receiving core. The receiving core for both teams, I'd say, is about even, because the Rams desperately miss Cooper Kupp. They're using guys like Gerald Everett, Josh Reynolds in his place. And as for the Patriots, Julian Edelman has proven to be the only reliable target. Or Rob Gronkowski is available when he's not double-teamed and when he's not doing bad. Because Gronk this year, let's face it, he's had a very down season. And there have been talks of him even trying to retire, which I guess is a fair idea, considering that this year has been one to forget for Gronk. Both teams, overall, though, have depleted receiving cores. And I'd say that this is an even category going into the Super Bowl. And I'll even argue this. The fact that, in that sense, whichever team has the better receiving core in the game specifically is probably going to win the game. Hey, if Robert Woods steps up for the Rams and Brandon Cooks, that's going to be a win for the Rams. Conversely, if Chris Hogan steps up and guys you wouldn't expect step up for the Patriots, they might win this game. So pay attention to the receiving core, because that's the one thing that's even amongst these predictions, and I feel that whomever does better in the Super Bowl itself in that game has a much better chance of winning the Super Bowl. So the receiving core, an important aspect, one though that on paper has both teams stacked up right against each other. Now to the offensive line. The Patriots have a slight advantage in this aspect simply because of this stat, quote, Tom Brady has thrown the ball 90 times in the postseason against Joey Bosa, Melvin Ingram, Jones, Ford, and Houston. And guess what? He hasn't been sacked once. Tom Brady has not been sacked once in the playoffs. Now, granted, it's only two games. They had a bye, but still, that's impressive. Now, the Rams rank 7th in the NFL in offensive line production, so they're right on the cusp. They're right there. I'm not going to argue that the Rams are necessarily bad, but you can't argue with the fact that Tom Brady has never been sacked once in the playoffs. By that logic, and that stat specifically, the Patriots have to have a slight advantage at offensive line. Let's go to defensive line. Without a doubt, this goes to the Rams. Look, Aaron Donald is a favorite and most likely a shoe-in for Defensive Player of the Year. He recorded 20 and a half sacks this season, and Ndamukong Suh is doing well in the playoffs. This is a superstar defensive line. It outnumbers whatever the Patriots are going to counter with. With the exception of Trey Flowers, there's no one on the Patriots' D-line that scares me. The Rams get the advantage here. In this aspect for linebackers now, I don't see much of an advantage either way. This is just about even. Both teams have some talent. For the Patriots, it's Kyle Van Noy. For the Rams, it's Dante Fowler. But either way, I don't see another true advantage here. So, again, the linebacking core, the receiving core, are two aspects in which both teams are about even. There's no real advantage either way. So, again, expect the linebacking core to play a significant role in this game. How are they going to defend? Will they record any sacks or blitz on the quarterback? Those are serious things that could determine the outcome of this game, considering that they're even statistically and on paper. And the secondary. In the secondary, despite talent on both sides, I feel that the Patriots have a slight advantage. I mean, how can you argue with Patrick Chung, the McCourty brothers, and Jonathan Jones? Four great players in the secondary for the Patriots. And even though Aqib Talib leads the Rams secondary, that's only one player. It's one on four. The Patriots have four legitimate defenders. The Rams only one. And because of that, the Patriots have the slight advantage. So just going through the preview and the picks one more time. The Patriots have the advantage at quarterback. Rams have the advantage at running back, receiving even. Offensive line to the Patriots slightly. Defensive line, undoubtedly the Rams. Linebacking aspect is even. And the secondary, it's a slight advantage to the Patriots. So overall, adding both of them up, it's about even. It's going to be a good game for sure. So let's get to the betting odds and my pick for the winner. Right now, as it stands, the Patriots are favored to win by 2.5 points with a 56.5 over-under. Now, first off on the over-under, I would definitely, without a doubt, take the under. I don't care about how explosive this Rams offense is. I don't see this game exceeding 56.5 points. The Patriots defense may not be Bears-like. They're not number one, but they are top 10. There's no way the Rams are scoring 30 points in this game. So if I were you and you're playing over-under specifically, take the under on 56.5. Because there's no way that I can see both these teams adding up to 56.5, 57 points. It's just not, it's not possible. Now, in regards to the line, 2.5 point favorite for the Patriots, I feel that it's quite accurate. I know the Rams are flashy. They have a great offense, have lots of superstar players. But again, you're facing Tom Brady, and your quarterback is Jared Goff. Again, no comparison in that aspect. Tom Brady is miles, leaps and bounds ahead of Jared Goff. That right there, that quarterbacking situation, will most likely explain the difference in this game. The reason the Patriots will win is because of their quarterback and nothing else. New England, in my eyes, will cover the spread, and they will win the game 28-24. That stays under 56.5, and that gives New England a 4-point win, covering the 2.5-point spread. And to me, it's unfortunate, because I don't want to see New England win again. I'm sick of hearing about them. I'm sick of seeing them in the Super Bowl. I'm sick of seeing them in the playoffs. I mean, they've made the playoffs every year since 2008. And 2008, by the way, they went 11-5 and missed the playoffs. But anyways, I think it's going to happen. The Patriots are going to win their sixth Super Bowl with Tom Brady. And again, a final score of 28-24. Covering the spread, staying under 56.5 points. Again, I'm not happy with that verdict. I don't want that to happen. I'm sick of hearing about the Patriots. But at the same time, although I'm sick of hearing about them, I respect what they're doing. This is a dynasty. This is probably one of the greatest sports dynasties that we are all going to live through. The Patriots and their Super Bowl championships had Tom Brady and Bill Belichick. So although it's sickening and it's boring to see them in the Super Bowl every year, see them contend every year, realize that you're watching history and that will there ever be a team like this to achieve this amount of success? Probably not. Not for a while. So enjoy what you're watching, even though it is Tom Brady, it is the Patriots, and realize that you're witnessing history. And also realize that this Super Bowl, win or lose for the Rams or Patriots, is going to be a great game between two of the best teams in the NFL. Have you guys ever heard about that guy upstate who lost his beer belly playing with his kids? Not surprising, considering regular physical activity and a healthy diet can decrease your weight and improve your health. Learn more at smallstep.gov, a public service announcement brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council. So we just finished up talking about the Super Bowl and my predictions. We went back and forth on positional rankings and gave a final score, which again, Patriots 28, Rams 24. And right now, we're going to move on and shift gears to baseball. The Baseball Hall of Fame results. The election results were revealed last Tuesday after all of the months of waiting and predictions and speculation. I dedicated a show back in November to every candidate on the ballot, all 35 players, and talked about the cases for and against all of them. But we now know, as of last Tuesday, who will formally be inducted into the Baseball Hall of Fame in July in Cooperstown. Last week, Mariano Rivera, Edgar Martinez, Roy Halladay, and Mike Mussina all received more than 75% of the BBWAA vote and are now heading to the Hall of Fame. Now, I want to take a closer look at each of the inductees, as well as those who didn't make the cut, understand why they didn't make it, and look forward to the years ahead and the voting process. As I mentioned last week, I knew Mariano Rivera was going to get in, but the question was, would Mariano be unanimous? Would a careless writer, more so, decide to leave the greatest closer of all time off the ballot? Because as I said last week, if you don't vote for Mariano Rivera, then you obviously have never watched baseball, number one, and number two, your ballot should be taken away from you right away. Luckily enough, that suspicion about who would leave him off the ballot has been put to rest because Mariano Rivera achieved even more history last Tuesday, becoming the first player in MLB history to receive unanimous election into the Baseball Hall of Fame. Now, before we even expound on that point, think about this for a minute. Mariano Rivera is the first ever to receive unanimous election. So that means when Babe Ruth was elected, not everyone voted for him. When Hank Aaron was elected, not everyone voted for him. When Ken Griffey Jr. was elected last year, not everyone voted for him. These are guys who are slam dunk first ballot Hall of Famers, yet they weren't voted for. There were writers who kept them off their ballots. Can you imagine in today's day and age if Babe Ruth was on the ballot? I cannot imagine anybody in their right mind who think it'd be sane to keep Babe Ruth off of their Hall of Fame ballot. But Mariano Rivera achieves unanimity, and rightfully so, he deserves it. But again, it's interesting to think that all of these great players in MLB history, I mean, Willie Mays, another great example, all of these guys have never achieved unanimous election. And today, we all think of them as the greatest players of all time. And surely Mariano is the greatest reliever of all time, but you're going to tell me that Babe Ruth should not have been in unanimously? You're going to tell me that Willie Mays should not have been in unanimously? Cy Young, Walter Johnson? I mean, that's just unbelievable. Anyways, Mariano is the first unanimous player to ever make it in. And again, rightfully so. Most saves of all time, which is a record that I think 651, something will never be broken. He has the highest ERA plus of all time amongst qualified pitchers with 1,000 plus innings pitched. And as we alluded to last week, across 96 appearances in the postseason, his ERA is 0.70. You can't argue with those numbers. And you can't argue with that unanimous election. Now again, should other people have gotten in unanimously before? Yes. But the point is now, Mariano, without a doubt, deserved to make it in unanimously. So congratulations to Mariano Rivera on his election. For Edgar Martinez, it took him all 10 years of eligibility, but finally, he's made it to the Hall of Fame. Edgar's offensive output, in my eyes, was never a question. I mean, with a 312, 418, 515 slash line, 300 homers, 2,200 hits, he always deserved consideration. What always hurt him, however, was his lack of defense, being a DH, and the fact that he never reached any significant milestones, which is all true. Those are glaring problems. Those are things that were addressed for 10 years, but now, after consideration and debate, Edgar Martinez is now a Hall of Famer. And in my eyes, you know what? It's right. I'm not saying Edgar is a first ballot Hall of Famer. Obviously, it took him 10 tries to get in. But in the end, I feel that Edgar should be in the Hall of Fame. He is one of the greatest designated hitters of all time. If you're one of the greatest at your position, you should be in the Hall of Fame. I mean, for crying out loud, there's an award named after him now. The Edgar Martinez Best Designated Hitter of the Year Award is given out every year in Major League Baseball, as of 2 years ago. He's been immortalized in a way. So again, If you're already immortalized by being named after for an award, there's no reason why you shouldn't be in the Hall of Fame. So I'm happy that the voters finally decided to realize what they were missing out on and understand that Edgar Martinez deserves to be in the Hall of Fame. Next up is Roy Halladay, and I have to say, they got this one completely wrong. Again, I understand that it's a great story. I mean, Halladay's death was tragic, and today, his family must continue on without him. I get it. It's a horrific story. But looking at the numbers, looking at his true stats, Halladay does not size up to being a Hall of Fame player. I mean, 203 wins, 2,100 strikeouts, that's not good enough. Curt Schilling has 216 wins, over 3,000 strikeouts, and right now, he's still facing an uphill battle. And Mike Mussina had to wait 6 years to get it in, despite having 270 wins, 2,800 strikeouts. This one truly doesn't make sense to me. I mean, congratulations to Roy Halladay and his family, but I'll always wonder why he made it in. And some people, I've heard this argument before, people telling me that, oh, Halladay is a Hall of Famer, but he's not a first ballot Hall of Famer. He shouldn't be getting in. No, he shouldn't be getting in at all. Roy Halladay should have never been elected to the Hall of Fame, period. End of story. And I'm shocked that the voters came around and voted him in on the very first ballot. It's just ridiculous. I don't like that vote at all. But I digress, and finally we get to Mike Mussina. Mussina waited 6 years, and the writers finally realized that, hey, he belongs in Cooperstown. Mussina, to me, though, from year one, was always a Hall of Fame pitcher. 270 wins, 2,800 strikeouts, and 83.0 career WAR, which I always like bringing this up as a statistical anomaly. His career WAR is actually better than Nolan Ryan's, which goes to show you how horrendous that stat is at tracking player success. Because if you're telling me that Mike Mussina was a more valuable pitcher than Nolan Ryan, you're crazy. But anyways, despite that fact, he has an 83.0 career WAR and an ERA plus of 123. He will be, in my mind, I think the last to get to 270 wins and deserves this immense honor. Now, as for the rest of the players, those who didn't get in, Fred McGriff has officially fallen off the ballot, a shame, receiving around 40% of the vote. I'm hoping he'll get in via the Veterans Committee, considering that Harold Baines and Lee Smith made it in this year. McGriff, as I've said many times on this show before, has always been a Hall of Famer to me. 493 homers, 1,500 RBIs, 2,500 hits. How can you argue with those numbers? I know that we will be mentioning his name amongst the greats in the future, just not now. But again, unfortunately, he's fallen off the ballot. And that's a shame because it's wrong. It's wrong by the writers to have him fall off after these 10 years. He should have gotten in at some point over the 10 years. As for Curt Schilling, he made some significant strides this year in the vote totals, receiving 61% of the vote, the most among those who did not get in. Three more years left of eligibility, and I feel that he too will get in eventually, and he should. Again, I don't care about his radio show. I don't care about his political statements on Breitbart Media, because here's the thing, he's not playing anymore. He'll never step on an MLB field again. Look, he didn't do this while he played in the league. It'd be completely different if that's how he was during his time in the league. But here's the thing, he's been retired for 10 plus years, hasn't picked up a baseball for a while, will never step onto an MLB field again, so why not let him talk about what he wants? Let him say what he wants. If his political views are considered wrong to people or considered, you know, whatever, just disrespectful, the point is, though, he's not on the field anymore. So it doesn't matter. Look at his numbers. Look at his stats. And if you want to sit here and say, oh, he's a bad ambassador for the game, Ty Cobb was a racist. And he was in first ballot in the Hall of Fame. So again, don't make that argument. Curt Schilling, based on numbers, is a slam dunk Hall of Famer. And I'm asking the Hall of Fame and their writers to get this one right in the future. As for Barry Bonds and Roger Clemens, both players did not make any significant strides in this year's voting totals. Clemens polled at 59.5%, Bonds at 59.1%, represents a 2% and 3% gain respectively. Again, although both players before steroids were Hall of Famers, their numbers right now, after steroids, are extremely inflated. And that's why the writers cannot simply let them in. Sure, they changed the game, but the question is, in what way? Is it okay to call Barry Bonds the all-time home run king and not Hank Aaron? Is it okay for Roger Clemens to post 354 wins and rank third all-time in strikeouts? Obviously, the voters don't think so. I don't think so, which is why they've never been elected yet. I mean, seriously. I understand they're both Hall of Famers, but when you're going to sit here and tell me that Barry Bonds is the all-time home run king now, that's a problem, with me at least. When you're going to sit here and tell me that Roger Clemens is top 10 all-time in wins, top 5 all-time in strikeouts, that's a problem to me. Because they never would have gotten there had they not used steroids. They would have been Hall of Famers. Barry Bonds would have hit 550, 600 home runs, would not have broken the record, though. Roger Clemens would have gotten 3,000 strikeouts, maybe even 4,000. Most likely would have gotten 300 wins, most likely, which is fine. But he wouldn't have been ranked fifth all-time in wins. He wouldn't have been ranked third all-time in strikeouts. So again, realize that both these guys, while they are Hall of Famers, their stats are inflated. And I'm not okay with letting Barry Bonds in, knowing he's going to be crowned, quote-unquote, the all-time home run king. I don't like that at all, and they deserve to pay the price for what they did during their career. Now, here's the one thing that worries me about the elections to come. Next year, the only notable addition to the ballot will be Derek Jeter, and in 2021, the most interesting players added are Tim Hudson and Mark Burley. So, with that in the mind, in the back of their mind, there will be lots of room for Hall of Fame voters to expand their ballots and vote for those who otherwise wouldn't receive a vote in a crowded year. Enter guys like Larry Walker, Omar Vizquel, Manny Ramirez, Todd Helton, Scott Rolen. Think about that. These are guys that could be considered Hall of Fame players in the next few years because writers will have the need, the compulsion to add 10 people on their ballot. The writers aren't comfortable with keeping their ballot at 5 or 6 people. Nope, they're going to vote for 10 people, and it doesn't matter who's on their ballot, which again means enter guys like Walker, Helton, all those guys who shouldn't be sniffing the Hall of Fame. Shouldn't even be on the ballot, if you ask me. None of those players mentioned, or others I haven't mentioned, deserve to be in the Hall of Fame. If anything, how about the writers get their act together and get Curt Schilling and Jeff Kent in the Hall? Or even Bonds and Clemens in? Because here's the thing. I understand that Bonds and Clemens, I just talked about them and how their numbers are skewed. But let me ask you this. Is it okay for a guy like Larry Walker to get in the Hall of Fame before Roger Clemens or Barry Bonds? Whether they use steroids or not, Clemens and Bonds made such a more significant impact on the game than Larry Walker could dream of making. There's no way Larry Walker should be in the Hall of Fame before Bonds or Clemens. So again, be happy for this year's inductees. For the most part, they all deserve to get in. I get, besides Roy Halladay, everyone else deserved it. But be wary of the future of the Hall of Fame, because if the writers have their way, we could be seeing lots of players who don't deserve to be in the Baseball Hall of Fame end up getting in. And that's a scary sentiment to be thinking about. The Illinois Department of Healthcare and Family offers free breast and cervical cancer screenings and low-cost treatment for uninsured women over 35, regardless of income. Screenings cost nothing and can save you everything. More information at cancerscreening.illinois.gov or 888-522-1282. So we just finished up talking about the Baseball Hall of Fame earlier, gave a comprehensive Super Bowl preview. And right now, we're ready for the Sports Talk Chicago flashback. And on this week's flashback segment, we're airing my interview with Ozzie Smith, Hall of Fame baseball player, ironically enough. We talked with him about his amazing playing career. We also talked with him, interestingly enough, about his thoughts on the Hall of Fame, who he thought should get in, and about the Veterans Committee and how they elected Baines and Lee Smith. Did they get that right or not? A lot of people say no, but I'll give you what Ozzie Smith has to say here in just a minute. After Ozzie Smith's interview, we got the call of the day. We'll also talk about the Chicago Bulls briefly and then end the show. So, lots still to come. Stay tuned. Here's my interview with Ozzie Smith right here on Sports Talk Chicago. Well, to start today, Ozzie, I have to ask about your nickname as I talked about the Wizard. Why the Wizard, and how did you end up getting that nickname? Is there a story behind it?
Well, you know, I don't know if there's a story behind it. In baseball, nicknames are very, very prevalent. And my name is Osborne. So most of my friends in my early days of playing baseball sports, period, everybody called me Oz. And I think they conflated that with the type of plays that I made and the Wizard of Oz. And it's sort of one of those things, John, that's always been there. Hard to explain how and when exactly it started, but it's something that's always kind of been with me. And I think it has to do with the fact that my name was so long, and in baseball we shorten names to come up with nicknames. So here I am, Oz.
So you're given this nickname because of this amazing defense, and rightfully so. I mean, as I mentioned, you've won 13 consecutive Gold Glove Awards. What was your secret? I mean, how were you able to sustain such success on defense and almost master the shortstop position in a way?
Well, John, I think it's just it's pride, it's confidence. It's, first of all, being blessed with great hand and eye coordination and understanding at an early age that, you know, that could be taken at any point, any time. So I never took anything for granted. I worked extremely hard every day knowing that or feeling that if this was going to be the last day that I had a chance to play, I wanted to be the best. And I just continued to strive to be the very best that I could be day in and day out, as consistent as I could possibly be. And when things were all said and done, you know, things would fall as they may. You know, I set out to be the best that I could be with my God-given talent, and didn't take anything for granted. And every day it allowed me to reach greater heights.
Ozzie Smith here on Sports Talk Chicago. And Ozzie, you mentioned 1977. I want to jump to 1978, your rookie year. Tell me about what happened in only your 10th game of the season. I mean, you made most arguably one of the greatest fielding plays in MLB history. Tell me what happened on that play and the reaction you received from your teammates.
Well, you know what? Here again, that day started like every other day. You know, we had a afternoon game, and Randy Jones was pitching, and I was just this little small 150-pound kid who had a nose for the baseball. And in this particular instance, Jeff Burrows is hitting. He hits a bullet up the middle. And just as I dive, the ball hits and goes back in the opposite direction that my body is going. And so my glove hand is gone. The only thing I can do is reach back with my bare hand while in the air. Somehow the ball stuck in my hand. I was able to scramble to my feet and throw Jeff Burrows out at first base. And that was the beginning for me as far as recognition is concerned. It wasn't until the next day that I realized that, you know, I had done something special. But for me, it was what I had done that had allowed me to get to the big league. So I wasn't doing anything different than I had already done. I had a nose for the baseball, and I was just tracking it down in that instance. And lo and behold, it stuck in my hand, and I was able to scramble to my feet and make a play.
Later that season, you also introduced your signature backflip, something that I think was very unique and entertaining, to say the least. Where did the idea for the backflips come from, and did you ever imagine it being as popular as it was?
No, John, I never did. It was one of those things growing up in South Central Los Angeles. I lived across the street from a wood factory, so we used to go over and tumble in the sawdust all the time, and as kids, we were always, I bet you can't do this, I bet you can't do that. So we did some pretty stupid and dangerous things as kids. But fortunate enough for me, I was, I became adept at being able to do it and do it on a consistent basis. So one day after practice, we had to run 2 miles. And I wasn't very fond of running too long distances. And so my teammates gave me a hard time about being the rookie and being near the back of the pack. So to show the guys that I wasn't tired, I did my my round-off backflip, and it entertained them so much that one of my teammates and the PR guy for the ball club thought it would be a good idea for me to do it on my way out the final day of the season, which was Fan Appreciation Day. I was a little reluctant to do it because, as you know, in San Diego, the chicken was the entertainment. So they coerced me into doing it. People liked it so much, they asked me to do it opening day the following year, and lo and behold, a trademark was born.
So you start spring training in 1982 with your new team in St. Louis, and your manager at the time, Whitey Herzog, wanted to find a way to improve your offensive production. Tell me about the wager that you guys made and how it worked out for you.
Well, you know, here I was a guy that he wanted me to be able to take advantage of my speed. And so for me to do that, I had to keep the ball out of the air because for some reason, anytime I hit the ball in the air, people thought I was trying to hit a home run. Well, I was never given credit for being smarter than that and knowing that I was not a home run hitter. I just had not had any real formal teaching as far as offense was concerned. I could put the ball in play, but learning to keep the ball out of the air was the important thing, or stay on top of the ball, which is the thing that he and some of the coaches that he assigned to me taught me how to stay on top of the ball and keep the ball out of the air. And for every ground ball I hit, he would give me a dollar. For every fly ball I hit, I'd give him a dollar. Well, with that being an incentive, midway the season, he said, this thing is over. So I learned very quickly at how to keep the ball out of the air, which allowed me to use more of my speed. And it really allowed me to be more effective as an offensive player.
And later that season, you guys had made it all the way to the World Series. You had forced a Game 7 against Milwaukee. In the sixth inning of that game, the Cardinals were down 3-1, and it seemed like maybe this wasn't going to be your year. What changed during that game, and what was it like for you to then come back and win the World Series with your team?
Well, it was great, you know, because that's what we all strive for. You know, we strive to be a part of something that is bigger than yourself. And when you have 25, 30 different personalities that you're dealing with, when you win and you win at that level, the achievement is one of great accomplishment because you were able to do it as a team. And winning with the group of guys that we had, you know, I was fortunate here in St. Louis that I got a chance to experience the World Series three times. And you don't get a chance to do that unless you have good teammates. And Whitey Herzog surrounded me with a lot of good teammates, and we played well together. We played off of each other, and we took a lot of pride in what we did each and every day. And in the long run, over 15 years here, you know, having the opportunity that I did was more than I could ever have dreamed of. Just getting an opportunity to play professionally was very, very special in and of itself. But to experience it at that level, at that high of a level, and then, you know, have that being capped off by being elected to the Hall of Fame after a 15-year career is very, very, very special.
Well, the postseason heroics didn't end with you there and the Cardinals, as in 1985, you hit a walk-off home run to win Game 5 of the NLCS. So first off, tell me about what happened in that moment and how you were able to come through for your team in such a clutch situation. And secondly, what did you think about Jack Buck's call when you first heard it?
Well, John, I tell you, you know, in 1985, I had a chance to meet. I was always a guy that had worked extremely hard with lifting weights and doing all of those things that to keep yourself strong over a 162-game schedule. But I had the good fortune of meeting a guy by the name of Mackie Shieldstone. Mackie Shieldstone took Michael Spinks from a light heavy to a heavyweight. And in visiting with Mackie, I told him what I was trying to accomplish. I was trying to put two halves together. You know, I would get off to a good start, and midway of the season, you know, everything that I'd worked on in the offseason was gone. So he helped me with nutrition, weight training, and really, he taught me about how to eat for life, not just for a season. So I had gotten a lot stronger. I'd learned how to pull the ball down in the corner. I got stronger, not necessarily hit the ball out of the ballpark, but to back the defense up. And the Dodgers would always pitch me in, and I'd learned how to turn on the ball. I continued to work hard on the fundamental aspects of it. And in that instance, I wasn't really trying to hit the ball out of the ballpark. I was just trying to get myself in scoring position. He supplied the power. I supplied the technique. And Jack Buck happened to be on the mic at that particular time. Smith corks one down the line. Could go. Go crazy, folks. Go crazy. The Cardinals have won the game by the score of 3-2 on a home run by the Wizard. I've heard that 1,000 times. I feel like I've hit 500 home runs on that call. And probably one of the best moments I ever had was that I was doing a card show one day, and I had a little kid come up to the table who could barely peep over a table. His name was Slade. And his mom said to him, "Why don't you do it for him?" The little kid came up, and he did that word for word. And she said that every time they get in the car, they had to put that tape on, and he did that. He memorized that whole thing. So it was pretty neat, and it's great to have been a part of that Cardinal moment.
And after winning the NLCS that year, you guys advanced the World Series. You come in as favorites and take a 3-2 series lead before the infamous blown call at first base by Don Denkinger. What did you see at your vantage point from shortstop, and why do you think that the call ended the Cardinals' World Series hopes in a way that year?
Well, you know, it's one of those things that you look back on it, and, you know, looking at today's play, you know, with instant replay, if we'd had the instant replay back then, we probably would be wearing another ring. But I don't think it was as much the call as it was how Mr. Denkinger reacted. He didn't even ask for any help. And I bet all Whitey and everybody on the club wanted was just ask somebody else, did they see something different? And they were reluctant to do that. And the reluctance to do that is where tempers really flared. And I think it was one of the reasons that Whitey and Joaquin both got kicked out of the game. It was the mere fact that he wouldn't ask for any help.
Do you think he should have asked for help? Do you feel that maybe he was a little too proud to ask for help and that could have hurt you guys as well? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, my thoughts are that it, at best, if that's the case, if that's what the other umpire saw, then fine. I think it leaves a bitter taste in your mouth, the fact that he did not ask for help and just became the judge, jury, and executioner all by himself.
Well, you mentioned your wonderful career, and of course, once your career ended in 2002, you received election into the Baseball Hall of Fame. How much did that honor mean to you, and what does it say about you and your journey to baseball immortality?
Well, it was meant that, and here again, I never looked at myself as a Hall of Famer. Hall of Famers were those, they were those guys, you know, the Koufaxes, the Gibsons, the Brocks, the Musials. You know, I never looked at myself in that same vein. All I knew is that I wanted an opportunity to play professionally, and if I could go out and be consistent and do my job to the best of my ability every day, then, you know, what happened after that, you know, was out of my control. You know, I had to control what I could control. And that's what I did over 19 years. I was as consistent as I could possibly be. I knew that every day that I left the ballpark, I asked myself the question, did I do the very best that I could do that day? And for 19 years, that answer was yes. I didn't leave anything out there. I knew that when I left the ballpark that night, even if we didn't win, I knew that I had given it all that I had that particular day. And I think that was what people appreciated, or people continue to appreciate about this organization. They know that we can't win every day. They just look for the effort day in and day out, and that's what I tried to give.
And today you're still involved with the Hall of Fame as a member of the Veterans Committee, which recently elected Lee Smith and Harold Baines, which is a decision that has angered some advocates for a more exclusive Hall of Fame. What is your response to those claims, and what are your thoughts on Baines and Smith getting in?
Well, you know, here again, it's kind of a fail-safe way to make sure that the writers didn't miss on guys getting into the Hall of Fame. Now, I didn't get a chance to play with Harold Baines. I saw him from a distance, and he certainly was a great player. I had a chance to play with Lee Smith. And when Lee Smith retired as the top saves leader in the game. you know, things have changed since he retired, but it was always baffling to me as to why he was always overlooked. So having had the opportunity to play with Lee Smith, I knew that he was very, very deserving of being in the Hall of Fame. And certainly, you know, having played with Raleigh Fingers, Bruce Sutter, Todd Worrell, Dennis Eckersley, and Lee Smith certainly belonged in that class.
What are your thoughts on steroid players getting in the Hall of Fame? I know that this isn't necessarily a Veterans Committee problem at the moment, but when it does become one, do you see guys like Barry Bonds and Roger Clemens getting in? And more importantly, do you think they deserve to be in?
Well, you know what? Before they were associated with steroids, those two guys, I think that you mentioned, Roger and Barry, were certainly Hall of Famers. And unfortunately, you know, they got caught up in the steroid era. And I think we all, everybody has their own personal feelings about it. For me, you know, if you break the rules, then, you know, you have to pay the consequences. And they certainly are, because they were associated with that. And as a Hall of Famer, you know, you don't want to be associated with something as negative as that. And, you know, so here we are. It appears that we have gotten a grip on it. And as we go forward here, I'm sure that you'll probably see some guys' numbers continue to creep up. And who knows, maybe one day they will. The other question that always comes up is that, what about Pete Rose? Well, you know, Pete Rose, I don't think, did anything that changed numbers as far as the game is concerned. So if you allow steroid guys to be in the Hall of Fame, then Pete Rose certainly deserves to be in the Hall of Fame for what he was able to accomplish on the baseball field.
Well, Ozzie, thank you so much for being here on the show today. Again, such an honor, and please come back soon. I really appreciate it.
All right, John. Thank you very much for having me.
That's my interview with Ozzie Smith. What a great guy. Great interview, too. Very candid about his career, about the Baseball Hall of Fame, and his thoughts on who should and shouldn't be let in. As I just said, an unbelievable and immense honor to have one of the greatest baseball players of all time on my show, on this show, and on my podcast, and really appreciative of the time that he gave me. So that was the Sports Talk Chicago flashback. It's now time for the announcer's call of the day, our signature segment here on Sports Talk Chicago. Last week in the NFC Championship game, the Rams and Saints were tied at 23 near the end of regulation. The Rams had the football and wanted to try and win the game before going to OT, thus sending out kicker Greg Zuerlein for what seemed to be like an impossible 57-yard field goal. Let's listen in to Joe Buck and Troy Aikman on the call for Fox Sports as Greg Zuerlein kicks the Rams to the Super Bowl. It's the Sports Talk, or it's the call of the day, excuse me, right here on Sports Talk Chicago.
You're not going to have interference on either team.
That was the first turnover by the Saints in this game. And this 57-yard try would be a Rams postseason record if it's good, and would send Los Angeles to Super Bowl 53. Bad snap. The kick is good. Rams win it, and on to Super Bowl 53 they go. Sean McVay and this Rams team on the road. And what a job by Johnny Hecker to get that snap from Jake McQuaid, get the football on its end, and then Zuerlein drills it from 57 to win the ballgame.
Well, the special teams unit.
Amazing call there by Joe Buck, and more specifically, an amazing kick by Greg Zuerlein. I mean, again, 57 yards to send your team to the Super Bowl. It's an NFL record, first of all, for longest game-winning kick in the postseason. And again, an amazingly clutch kick, something that I think the Bears would have wanted back in the wild card game and, of course, in Week 6. So we've got only a couple of minutes left on this show. And instead of going to the Bulls, I saw a texter got to me. So we'll end with this. A texter texted me about the Baseball Hall of Fame from the 708 area code, so local, and told me that I'm wrong about good players being eligible in the years to come. What I was told is that Joe Mauer is a viable Hall of Fame candidate. Come, I believe it's going to be 2023. The texter didn't know the exact year, but he said, watch out for Joe Mauer and his Hall of Fame candidacy in the future. Now, of course, Mauer just retired this past season, so he's got 5 years to wait, starting with 2019, so 19, 20, 21, 22. So it'd be 23, he'd be eligible. Where do I start with this? Because this is the most ridiculous argument I've ever heard. Joe Mauer is not a Hall of Famer. It's not even close. Look, I understand he hit 306. You know, his OPS was 827. His OPS plus 124. He's a very good player. He has an MVP award to his credit. Okay? But here's the thing. Mauer has only played in 140-plus games on three separate occasions. He's played in 150-plus games only once in his entire career. So the guy can't stay on the field. Later in his career, starting at age 32, he never played catcher anymore. Couldn't do it. He had to go to first base. So then the question becomes, where are you going to put him should he be elected as a catcher or first baseman? And third, and I think this is the most glaring point, not close to any milestones. 2,100 hits, 140 homers, 900 RBIs. I mean, I'm sorry, but Joe Mauer's not a Hall of Famer. A great player, very good career. But if you're telling me that Joe Mauer deserves to be in the Hall of Fame, you're crazy. I mean, come on now. If Joe Mauer's a Hall of Famer, then let's let anybody in. I don't care at that point. But that's ridiculous that Joe Mauer is going to be considered a Hall of Fame candidate, at least by this texter, and probably for sure by the baseball writers, when he becomes eligible in 2023. Look, the Hall of Fame is reserved for the best of the best. And Joe Mauer's offensive statistics are not the best of the best. His defensive statistics aren't even close to being the best of the best, again, because he stopped playing catcher 3 or 4 years ago. Then he just became a full-time DH. Actually, yeah, the first year that happened, 2014, he became a full-time DH. So for the last 4 years of his career, he played a total of one game at the catching position, the rest of his time at first base and DH. When he did play catcher, he was good. I admit, yes, a very good player, but he didn't play there for long. And again, despite the MVP award, I get it. He had a great year that 1 year. 365 batting average, 28 homers. But other than that, Mauer is just a good player. He hit 306. He's good. Nowhere near being a Hall of Famer. That argument is flawed. I don't appreciate it. I can't believe that this texter feels that Joe Mauer is a Hall of Famer because I completely disagree with that argument. I know you want to elect everybody, and I know you're trying to be compassionate about it, but realize that there are a lot of players who don't deserve to be in the Hall of Fame. Actually, 1% of all Major League players in history are in the Hall of Fame. It's an immense honor. Don't take it personally if you're left out. The point is, only 1% get in. And Joe Mauer is not part of that 1% in my eyes. Therefore, he's not a Hall of Famer. Case closed. Again, I don't know where that logic's coming from. I don't appreciate it. Joe Mauer is not a Hall of Famer. End of story. Well, that does it for us today. I hope you enjoyed our show. Again, I'm John Zaglul here for Sports Talk Chicago. You can find me on Twitter at John Z Sports, Instagram at John Zag, and Facebook and LinkedIn at John Zaglul. Make sure to tune in to SportsTalkChicago.com. More articles and podcasts, again, as I mentioned at the top of the hour. Len Casper joining me on my podcast today. It'll be up by noon. So make sure to check that out. Please remember to tune in next Monday and every Monday at 9 a.m. to get your latest Chicago sports fix. And at this time, I'd like to thank the University of Chicago, WHBK, and show contributor Ozzie Smith for today's show. We'll sign off with music by TMMRW. Remember, his newest single with Juice WRLD also drops this Friday anywhere you receive your music, whether it be Apple Music, Spotify, or Google Play. Thank you again for listening. We will see you next week.
We'll be right back.